To the second case of the day, United States versus Bell. Mr. Anderson.
Yes, may it please the court, I'm Kent Anderson with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, representing the appellant Adrian Bell. In this case, Mr. Bell was convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm, sentenced 285 months into the Armed Career Criminal Act. And there are several problems with Mr. Bell's conviction and sentence. I'll start with the fact that the district court should have continued the sentencing hearing in order to allow the probation officer to receive the Social Security records, which he had requested but hadn't yet got, which we now show that he had an IQ of 52. This would have given both the court and the parties accurate information on which to base Mr. Bell's sentence and might have triggered the need for a competency determination. Obviously not sure what trial counsel would have done with that. I'm sure he would have argued mitigating sentencing, though. The First Circuit has set forth helpful circumstances to evaluate when looking at a denial of continuance. Those are the delay entailed, the reasons for the request, whether the moving party is at fault, and any inconvenience to the court and litigants, whether the denial would unfairly prejudice the moving party. And in this case, all of those factors suggested that a continuance was appropriate. Probably would have been only a short further delay to get the records from the Social Security Administration. Mr. Bell wasn't responsible for the delay. Somebody at the Social Security Administration was. The government concurred in the motion, so we know they wouldn't have been significantly inconvenienced, and there's no evidence that the court would have been either. In fact, judicial economy would have favored it by eliminating this issue and possibly others for appeal. And the reasons were extremely important in order to get a recent picture of Mr. Bell's mental state. There was some things in the pre-sentence report, but it showed that he had an IQ of 70. Well, there's a big difference between that, which would have put him at the borderline between mild mental retardation and low average intelligence, and 52, which would put him in the borderline between mild and moderate mental retardation. And with mild retardation, people usually attain an academic performance of sixth grade level or higher, but with moderate, it's usually not beyond second or third grade. And this, of course, helps explain why Mr. Bell had trouble understanding some of the proceedings, such as the old chief stipulation and his sentencing documents. As the Supreme Court and others recognize, mental retardation is a significant mitigating factor at sentencing because people who are mentally retarded often act on impulse and they're less able to control their behavior and learn from mistakes. And not only would this have affected Mr. Bell's culpability for the instant offense, but it could have affected the district judge's evaluation of his criminal history, which certainly some of those offenses could have been impulsive. And it had obvious implications for competency. This court in United States v. Schwarr dealt with a different issue arising after Judge Evans, as the district judge, found the defendant incompetent due to mental retardation, and several other federal courts have made similar findings. And, of course, the biggest reason for this is, as the Supreme Court noted in Atkins, mental retarded defendants may be less able to assist counsel, even though they may understand the proceedings and the consequences against them. It also might have supported a motion for due trial based on new evidence that his Miranda waiver wasn't knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently made. Therefore, the judge's refusal to continue the hearing was effectively an arbitrary insistence that speed was more important in this case than anything else, including an accurate sentencing hearing. Now, getting back to Mr. Bell's conviction, was also an abuse of judge should have excluded the shooting evidence under Rule 403. because not only was it minimally probative, as the district judge found before trial even, this case wasn't a case with a missing gun or anything like that, but it was also extremely prejudicial. Juries hear evidence about a shooting, and they're going to take that into account against anybody who they think was even partially involved. That's going to color their view of the evidence. And as the D.C. Circuit recognized in Patterson, where they found that the government shouldn't have asked about a shooting that happened on the street shortly before the defendant was arrested. That was also sort of a gun case. It was a silencer, not the gun itself, but similar. The government has pointed to the rifle as an alternative basis for the verdict, and it could have been, but the jury heard evidence that Mr. Bell thought the rifle was a BB gun. And if they believed that, they would have had to follow their instruction not to base a guilty verdict on the rifle. So what we have here is the Glock evidence regarding the shooting could have affected the general verdict that may have been based on, the pistol. So it wasn't harmless. And even assuming that the evidence was properly admitted, in that case, Mr. Bell should have been allowed to introduce evidence that there were no fingerprints found on the pistol. It was certainly relevant to show that it was somewhat less likely that he possessed the gun under Rule 401. The district judge relied on this court's decision in Palladino, which was decided a couple days before trial, I think, in which the court said that it wasn't relevant. And in that case, that made perfect sense. The gun was in the defendant's car, and he admitted knowing it. So he possessed the gun whether he ever touched it or not. But when there's a dispute over possession, then it's relevant, as the Ninth Circuit found in a case in which they relied on that factor and several others to find insufficient evidence of knowing possession. And finally, the court shouldn't have relied on Mr. Bell's statutory rape conviction to support the Armed Career Criminal Act enhancement, because the facts that it was allowed to consider under Shepard, the charging document, statute of conviction, etc., didn't show that it was a crime of violence. Now, this court did previously in Shannon hold that statutory rape of a 13-year-old is a crime of violence, but that was decided before Shepard and therefore is no longer good law. Shannon relied on medical articles outside the charging documents to determine the fact that a 13-year-old is more likely to suffer sexually transmitted disease and become pregnant with complications than an older girl, although it didn't decide how much older. After Shannon, this court relied on the absence of similar sociological facts to hold that statutory rape of a girl who might have been at least 16 by a man who may have been 22 or less was not a violent felony. That was in Thomas. And the First Circuit also remanded for factual determination of risks to a 14-year-old. The district court held an evidentiary hearing, which further shows that this is a factual determination that can't be normally made just on the charging documents. I suppose it could have if the legislature had made the findings in the statute, but that didn't happen in this case. And the Tenth Circuit very recently questioned whether evidence of the general risk of injury to minors is allowed by Shepard, and found specifically that statistical or medical analysis goes beyond the scope of Shepard. Now, it didn't matter in that case because they follow a different course than this court does, and I'm not suggesting this court follow theirs, finding that absence of legal consent is the criteria. But the factual dispute is probably why both the Sixth and First Circuits found that courts have neither the expertise nor the authority to resolve these issues in the first instance. Drawing the line at what age sexual intercourse presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to a post-pubescent girl is a determination of medical fact beyond the scope of what's allowed by Shepard, and if it's to be made, should have been made by a jury. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Ms. Rembolo.
May it please the Court, Rita Rumbelow, and I represent the United States in this case. I'm going to address the issues in the order that Mr. Anderson did. First of all, it was not an abuse of discretion for Judge Shabazz to refuse to continue the sentencing hearing in this matter. Judge Shabazz presided over these proceedings. This is a case that went to trial. Judge Shabazz saw Adrian Bell. He saw his demeanor. Judge Shabazz also knew that Adrian Bell had been represented by three different attorneys in this case. None of those experienced defense attorneys filed any motions questioning Mr. Bell's competency. The case went to trial. The PSI comes out. It's issued 35 days later. We know in paragraph 92 of the PSI that Mr. Bell did suffer from some level of mental retardation, and Judge Shabazz clearly considered that when he decided to sentence Mr. Bell within the middle of the advisory guideline range. So this isn't a situation where Judge Shabazz abused his discretion, because he did consider it as yet another delay tactic. Mr. Bell kept firing his attorneys, kept being reappointed new attorneys, and again, at that point, three attorneys had discussed the case with Mr. Bell, had been in his presence, planning for the defense, went to trial, and none of them raised this issue. So it is very speculative, and as Mr. Anderson just stated, he's not sure what trial counsel would have done had he received the Social Security records prior to sentencing. So it's just mere speculation as to what counsel would have done on the basis of these records.
Well, Ms. Rumbelow, that's a pretty dramatic drop in numbers, if that's accurate, right? I mean, to go from 70, which carries its own connotation, to a significantly lower number, might that not... And again, I suppose it's in the area of speculation. Might that not have, if known by defense counsel, any of the defense counsel, perhaps explained the quality or lack thereof of the dialogue between them? Maybe might even explain the change of counsel. I don't want to make the case. There's no case to be made on this. But that the drop moves to a whole other category, doesn't it, of capacity?
It is a significant drop. However, again, Mr. Strang sat through trial with Mr. Bell. He stated on the record that Mr. Bell didn't understand the importance of entering into the old chief stipulation, especially because of the nature of the prior conviction that the government was going to introduce. So although it is a significant drop, again, you're dealing with paperwork and the PSI said that Mr. Bell suffered from a level of mental retardation. Hard-pressed to see how it couldn't have been so evident to the attorney that they sit here and are implying that the district court abuses discretion just because of something that they had not done yet, that they had not moved for competency. And again, three different attorneys represented Mr. Bell. So although on paper it appears to be a significant difference, I guess the government's position is, how could that not have been so evident to three different defense attorneys? So although it appears to be a significant difference on paper, in reality, it really may not have been.
Well, as to this defendant's capacity, he didn't testify at trial, right?
He did not.
So are we limited as far as Judge Shabazz's observation to whatever dialogue occurred at sentencing? Is that...
Well, no. We have a final pretrial or a final hearing before every trial. So Judge Shabazz, saw Mr. Bell's demeanor at the final hearing Friday before.
What exchanges occurred between the judge and and Mr. Bell, if any?
At the final hearing, none. And then the morning of trial, we have another hearing, and then we have trial. And then, Judge Shabazz witnessed Mr. Bell's demeanor. I specifically recall Mr. Bell was having... He was struggling with whether or not he should testify. And Mr. Strang and Mr. Bell were standing there during trial outside the presence of the jury. And Mr. Bell was trying to make up his mind of whether or not he wanted to testify. And that took quite some time. So, again...
Was there any dialogue between the judge and Mr. Bell on that issue? Was that struggle that Judge Shabazz saw his view of the comments between counsel and Mr. Bell?
It was, if my memory is correct, it was just Mr. Bell communicating with counsel and then counsel communicating to the court. But again, three different defense attorneys. And again, it's just whether or not Judge Shabazz abused his discretion and refusing to continue a sentencing hearing. And he made it clear on the record that he considered Mr. Bell's mental retardation a mitigating factor, and he did not sentence him at the high end of the guideline range because of that. So it's speculative to suggest that Judge Shabazz, had he found out that his IQ really was 52, that therefore he would have gone below the middle of the guideline range. He was aware of Mr. Bell's struggles and fully took that into consideration, so there was no abuse of discretion. Turning to the evidence of the shooting, it was not an abuse of discretion either to admit this evidence, and there was no unfair prejudice. I mean, the probative value was so important in this case. You had law enforcement officers executed a search warrant at Mr. Bell's apartment. The Glock pistol was wrapped in a white T-shirt underneath a couch, and there were other people in the apartment. So the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Bell knowingly and intentionally possessed that firearm, and there was no other way to do that but briefly. And the facts of the shooting evidence were quite brief. And, you know, it's just that Mr. Bell admitted he had possessed a pellet gun. He was familiar with weapons. He'd gotten into a fight. He thought that he was going to get shot at, so what he did was he called his brother Curtis because he knew Curtis had a pistol. And then the shooting occurred, and the police sat outside Mr. Bell's apartment for hours, and they knew that he didn't, you know, leave the apartment and that he was in it that entire time. And so, and then when they found the firearm in the apartment, we were able to link it to the shooting, and so it was extremely probative, and it was not outweighed by any unfair prejudice at all, and there was no error. But even if there was, it was completely harmless because, again, we had evidence of the Marlin rifle. And on appeal, they haven't challenged the sufficiency of that evidence, and the jury also could have convicted on that basis. Judge Shabazz also did not abuse his discretion by granting the government's motion in limine that the defendant could not introduce any evidence on the absence of fingerprints. Palladino is quite clear. Since no fingerprints were found, neither side was helped, and it's completely irrelevant. So, again, there was no abuse of discretion there either. And finally, this court does not need to revisit the Shannon decision. That decision was correctly decided. This court looked at the judgment of conviction in Shannon and the charging document, the information. Both of those documents are what the Supreme Court has told us we're allowed to look at to determine what a defendant has been convicted of. So once the court decides what the defendant has actually been convicted of, and in Adrian Bell's case, we know it was second-degree sexual assault of a 13-year-old. And on the judgment of conviction alone, we knew that he had engaged in intercourse with this 13-year-old because she was pregnant. So based on just the judgment of conviction, we know that that's the conduct. Well, who gets to decide then, as a matter of law, whether that conviction otherwise involved conduct that presented a serious physical risk of physical harm to others, of physical injury to others? And that's purely a question of law. And again, once this court looks at documents that both Shepard and Taylor have said that we're allowed to look at, determine what somebody has been convicted of, then the court is allowed to consider articles, journals, anything to help it decide, again, as a matter of law, what type of risk that conduct involved. So again, Shannon does not need to be revisited, and the district court correctly sentenced Adrian Bell as an armed career criminal. Therefore, I ask that this court affirm the judgment and conviction order.
Thank you, Ms. Rambeau. Mr. Anderson.
Yes. Thank you. Just briefly, I have to note that Judge Shabazz couldn't have relied on the information in Social Security records because he didn't know about it. I mean, he knew in a general way that there was something out there, but he didn't know specifically what it was.
What did he know? He was on disability for a mental
That was reported, yes. That it was also reported that it might have been in part due to asthma. So how much was one and how much was the other was not known at that time, and what the level of mental disability was certainly was not known at all. I mean, you know, what the Social Security Administration.
The pre-sentence report did say he had a 68 IQ or something like that.
It said verbal IQ of 68, full scale of IQ of 70. That's correct. Which, as I said, you know, it certainly that alone is somewhat mitigating, but nowhere near as much as the IQ of 52.
What bothers me, though, is the comment here that three lawyers had contact with him, and not one of them. And we presume lawyers are doing an adequate job, and not one of them thought that his situation was so dire that they had trouble communicating with him. There was never a competency question that was raised. And I don't know, maybe it was never raised in any of these prior convictions that were used to make him a career criminal.
Well, Mr. Strang did actually tell the court when he was discussing the old chief stipulation that he and Mr. Lieberman did have trouble communicating with Mr. Bell and getting him to understand concepts. Unfortunately, it's not always easy to determine whether somebody meets the very minimal standard for competence or they're simply difficult for some other reason. And he and Mr. Lieberman had only been appointed 26 days before trial, so that was certainly not going to be their only focus, and they didn't have a lot of time. With respect to the other attorneys, I honestly don't know. I have not spoken to them. I don't know how much contact they had with Mr. Bell before they were relieved or anything else.
What's Mr. Strang's first name?
Dean.
And he is the federal defender, the federal defender in
the
Eastern District. He was until just recently,
yes.
One of the better lawyers in the state, I think.
I would tend to agree with that, although certainly anybody can make mistakes, but even the best. The only other thing I had, the discussion about Mr. Bell testifying, I'm sure it happened, but it's not on the record, so we don't know exactly what was said or what the, or who observed what. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Thanks to both counsel, and Ms. Anderson, an additional thanks to the Mr. Parsons and your staff at the Central District for venturing north to take this case from Wisconsin. All right. Case is taken under advisement.